access number 12149, reel 8.
Captain Sutton, reel 8.
I knew that if the stern was going to be sticking out into Suda Bay, that destroyers wanting fuel would be able to run in and berth alongside the stern, whereas the forepart of the tanker would be aground. So in actual fact, what we were making was a jetty filled with oil. Anyhow, this is what happened. And I went back and reported what I had done to the naval officer in charge, who was furious. He said he hadn't given me permission to beach her. Anyhow, I listened to him discussing with another officer whether they were going to court-martial me, and then I walked away and left it at that. I managed to get a lift out to Malamy, and I reported to Commander Beale, the commanding officer there. It was still quite early in the morning, you see. I mean, asked him if I could get a lift down to Alexandria by air. He said no. He said he wanted me to stay and act as his operations officer for the evacuation of Greece, that his airfield was becoming a frontline RAF airfield, and it was going to have to provide fighter cover for the ships evacuating Greece, and that I was to be the operations officer. Well, I wasn't terribly keen on this, really. I mean, I had already been chivvied a bit around the airfields in Greece, and I didn't see that I really wanted to be on a frontline airfield under main German attack. But there was, I was told that this was my fate. And so I went round with Beale, round the airfield, meeting the fighter pilots. At that stage, the last of the Swordfish crews had been got out of the place. The Air Force had said that they wanted the airfield cleared of everything but fighters in order that it would be completely free to operate the greatest efficiency as a fighter airfield, and the Swordfish had been flown down to Alexandria. 805 Squadron, a naval fighter squadron, a sort of composite squadron put together to protect Suda Bay, was there. Now, they had Fulmers, Sea Gladiators, biplane Sea Gladiators, and Buffaloes. That was an American aircraft provided on the lease end. A mixed squadron, and I can't remember the number of aircraft, it was about a dozen altogether. Alan Black, Lieutenant Commander Alan Black, was the commanding officer. And that lunchtime, I got out to there and was talking to the pilots and Alan Black, who had been introduced, when it was noted that out in the midday sun there, sitting under one of the Fulmers, was a Cretan workman. So a couple of guards were sent out to bring him in, because no Cretan workmen were allowed on the airfield itself, except when they were doing construction. As these guards approached, the chap got up and dropped something behind him. This was found to be a pair of wire clippers. So the aircraft was examined. A Fulmer was a fighter aircraft for carrier use, and the wings folded, and at the wing hinges there were all sorts of connections electrical and hydraulic connections. And this man had been clipping the connections. So here was a saboteur. He was handed over to the Australian infantry who were guarding that area, and they were told to take him into Carnia, the capital, which was the Greek military headquarters, and hand him over to the Greeks. About a quarter of an hour later, they came back, and we said, oh, Christ, what have you done with the prisoner? You haven't let him escape. He said, oh, no, he's all right. We said, what have you done with him? He said, oh, for Christ's sake, you wanted him shot, didn't you? And we said, yes. They said, well, we've shot him. He's in the ditch, 1 mile down the road, outside the village. We wouldn't have any more trouble from that village. So that was that. Made an uneasy feeling because the Greeks were allegedly very much on our side. On the other hand, it was known that the Greeks, a lot of them, had been very pro-German. There was a lot of trade with the Germans. The Germans had trained their army, and the Germans had trained their air force. And therefore, one was a little bit unhappy at this sort of situation. One became wary of the Greeks, although they did turn out to be the most magnificent friends and protected people. At that stage, we were a little bit dubious as to how they were going on to behave. And anyhow...
Was that the only case of sabotage you came across in Crete?
The only case of sabotage I came across a spy a bit later, but I'll tell you about that as I get to it. The only case of sabotage I came across, yes, on my first day at Malawi. I then sized up my job. I found that the operations room was a tin hut on the hillside above the runway. And I said, God's sake, you can't operate from that. You've seen what the Germans do to airfields. You want an underground shelter of some sort. And I was given permission to use some of the Greek workmen to make an underground shelter. There was no time, really, to make a cut-and-cover shelter with concrete over the top and that sort of thing as one had in Britain. But we started a tunnel into the hillside under a strata of rock and went in several yards over the next few days, hacking away with picks and shovels at the hillside and supporting the roof of rock until there was a sort of underground room. It became obvious after a very short time that there wasn't going to be time to finish a shelter. What was needed, in actual fact, was to increase the length of the runways and improve the airfield, and every workman should put on that, and not making shelters for Alan Sutton. So my underground shelter, which was called Alfie's Folly, was abandoned, and all the workmen were put on to making extensions to the runways. I said that my job was to be the operations officer for the evacuation of Greece. We had at the airfield the 805 squadron, with the next squadron, but of course they were all fairly close-range fighters. We also had number 30 Blenheim squadron. I don't think that was one of those composite squadrons where they had one fighter fighters and one fight of bombers. The same basic aircraft, but one was fitted up as a fighter, and was one of the earliest sort of night fighters one used as well. But the fighter Blenheims, and we also had some Hurricanes arriving. These were mostly 33 Squadron, RAF, who had been knocked out of Greece and were in a pretty bad way. I mean, they'd lost a lot of pilots in Greece. The air crews had been chivvied to hell on the airfields they'd been on, which shot up by the Germans. And so 33 Squadron was there, but really in a state of trying to be reformed. And one or two other Hurricanes also arrived there from miscellaneous squadrons that sort of joined in for a period. But those are the main things, 33 and 805 squadrons. As I say, 815 Squadron had been got out of it to make room for the others. The overall defence of Crete was under Group Captain Beamish Air Force, and Beale was put under him, and on the 1st of May we became an RAF airfield. But the Air Force had not got the personnel, or indeed I think the will, to man it up completely. It did not provide a new commanding officer to replace George Beale, he was in the not entirely happy position of finding himself the commanding officer of a fighter airfield, trying to operate fighters in a most ad hoc sort of manner. The first operations we did were this business of covering the evacuation from Greece. The first lots of British and a certain number of Greeks were evacuated from a place to the west, just west of Athens, Monomvasia, I think its name is. What happened there was that we managed to get the fighter Blenheims overhead at about dawn, and the ships had to get at least, I can't remember, about 2 hours steaming off the coast so they wouldn't get caught by the German fighters. So you had a rendezvous, the longer range British fighters rendezvousing at sea with the ships which had to leave at least 2 to 3 hours before dawn. And then as the ships moved down south towards Suda Bay, the shorter range fighters took over and covered them. My job was to arrange this going on. Then, as the Germans poured into Greece, they took Athens, Monomvasia fell, and then there were two ports right in the south of the Peloponnesus, which were used to get off as many as possible. They were Nauplia and Kalamata. Nauplia and Kalamata. And the same thing happened there. You know, right out of the south of Greece, there was all the three fingers sticking out into the sea, one of which is Metapan. And it was right from that area that the evacuation was taking place across a fairly short range of sea. We were under intense German air attack by then. The Germans had moved down into the Peloponnesus and were actually operating from dirt airfields very close to the evacuation beaches and were knocking hell out of us. Most of the ships got away, all right. One or two were sunk, but nearly all got away, and not only ships, liners and so on, but a large number of what were then, in those days, were called A-lighters. They were sort of very first of the big landing craft, were used also in evacuation. They had been sent up there for operations in the Dardanelles and so on, and weren't used on that. And they were used from Suda Bay again in ferrying people down to Crete. I can't remember the date that the evacuation finished, but the Germans got into Kalamata, rounded up all the remaining British troops, Then the thing was that the full attention was turned on to Crete. They concentrated to start with on Suda Bay and knocking out the shipping, and then Malamy started to come in for very heavy air attacks. On the 1st of May, the day that the Air Force took over, was also a day of change. It was the day that General Freyberg took over as the general commanding in Crete. And it was also the day on which a radar station came into operation above Malamy. This was, in the parlance of the day, it was called Air Ministry Experimental Station, AMES, up in the hills above Malamy, and of course gave a certain degree of fighter direction. At this stage, I was relieved as operations officer by an RAF officer, and in actual fact, of course, the whole tenor of operations changed, because no longer was it protection of shipping at sea, now it was fighter protection and protection of Crete. So in actual fact, I was then relieved of the job, and by an RAF officer. In fact, RAF officers were filtering in gradually to take over the various positions of the naval officers at Malamy. We had a works and bricks officer to look after the making of the airfield, a chap called Deakin, and some time in about the first week in May, a new commanding officer called Howell arrived to take up a 33 squadron and to reform it. The thing took on more and more of an RAF tenor, but still Beale was there, and we still ran as a naval air station. We had a first lieutenant, executive officer, lieutenant commander, Royal Naval Volunteer Reserve, and he got very windy. Well, now let me just go back a little bit here on this. So I was therefore had finished my job, which Beale had held me behind. And was working as a general officer on duty in the station. As an observer, I flew quite a number of times with the New Zealand commander of the area. When I first arrived there, there were Australians in Defence of Malamy. With the evacuation from Greece, the New Zealand forces from Greece were put in the area, and we had a brigade. And there was a battalion, the 22nd Battalion of New Zealanders, put in actual in defence of the Malamy airfield itself. The commanding officer was Lieutenant Colonel Andrews, VC from the First World War. I've said that we got rid of the Swordfish aircraft, but there was one left behind which wasn't serviceable and it couldn't fly the distance to Egypt over the sea. We had a naval armament officer, Dennis Luff, Lieutenant Dennis Luff, who was relieved about this time by an RAF officer, who again took over the job of armaments officer of the air station, and Luff concentrated on making this aircraft serviceable. We had a certain number of ground crews still there who could operate a naval aircraft, and of course 805 who had quite an experience of Swordfish as well. I flew on quite a number of flights with Luff and with Colonel Andrews, examining the developing defences from the air as Andrews defended the area. Andrews was most particular that nothing could be spotted of his defensive trenches or his minefields or anything else. All the spoil had to be dispersed completely. There had to be no sign of disturbed earth. Every slip trench had to have camouflage on it so that the edge could not be seen. There had to be no tracks leading into it. He was the most meticulous. Now, he had experienced the German air superiority, the whole of the fight down from the north of Greece down that east coast, and knew precisely what was required in ground defense against a superior enemy air force. The result was that the New Zealand positions were extremely well camouflaged and very well disposed, that very difficult indeed to spot. It could have been done by skilled photographic interpreters, but I don't think the Germans had those at that stage. They were doing it very largely by eye. And as I say, I flew a number of occasions, three or four occasions I flew with Colonel Andrews. And I also got to know the Colonel quite well. We'd go back into the mess. We had a joint mess. The naval mess was joined by the New Zealanders and by some Royal Marine officers who actually came into the area. I'll explain that. And Andrew told me about the fighting in Greece, and I got a distinct impression of a line being held from the mountains to the sea and gradually pulling back in front of the Germans and holding and then preparing another line and in the night falling back on the new line but leaving a rear guard on the original position, which then would meet the German dawn attack, and they would pull back onto the new defensive position, again which would be held by the New Zealanders. Andrew told me that the Germans did not like night fighting, and they much preferred a dawn attack. So I got a very distinct impression of the way that a battle against the Germans was being fought, or could be fought. We became quite friendly. I wouldn't say intimate, because he was a much older man than I was, but he told me quite a lot and was very frank. And I was helping him, of course, in the air, spotting his positions and noting down things for him. Eventually, Dennis Luff got this swordfish really flying quite well, and he was told that he could take it to Alexandra, but to be one long flight along the whole of the island and back to make quite certain that it had the range and could make it. Now, I was to fly with him. I was to be his observer, and we were to take four Greek bomber aircraft. These were Avros, again, evacuated from Greece. They're biplanes, and I insulted the Greek pilots very much when I queried whether it was worthwhile flying training aircraft down to Egypt. And they said, these are not training aircraft, these are operational aircraft. When you come to think of it, of course, we had the same sort of thing flying up in the Northwest Frontier only a year or two earlier, very much the same. Very suitable for fighting up in near Piraeus and so on. Anyhow, I was to navigate down and we were to lead these four Greek aircraft. At this stage, the first lieutenant broke completely. I couldn't take the incessant air attacks which were developing on the airfield and took to the hills. He'd come down for meal times, but he slept up in the hills, and he kept up in the hills all day and just came down for food. Well, that was no use. And Veal thought of court-martialing him, but just sent him away with an adverse report. And I offered to stay on, instead of flying down in the Swordfish, to act as Beale's assistant, because he was being left high and dry at this stage. All the naval officers being left, and here was the naval commanding officer being left with no support from his own service, an intensely developing situation of strain and an insistent enemy air attack. So I said that I would stay if he wanted me. And he said, yes, please. And so I stayed on in Crete and acted as Beale's assistant. In fact, I was, in effect, the adjutant of an RAF station, really, when it comes down to it. I took on all sorts of jobs, like mostly it was manning the defences, organising defences. We had very inadequate arms. On the airfield itself, although the area itself became fairly well armed. We had the 22nd Battalion New Zealanders, and they had the main heart of that defensive position was the hill to the south of south of Malaby, called Hill 107. I don't know what it's Capronitis, I think it was named, and name like that, but Hill 107 it was in red. And that was the heart of their positions. Now, on that hill also, there were established, moved in, a contingent of the Royal Royal Marine Base Defence Organisation, RMBDO. This was an organisation which was put down to defend harbours, which we took over in various parts of the world, and provided harbour nets, defences. It provided anti-aircraft fire for ships in harbour. It provided coast defence, guns, and all sorts of things like that, to put down defences for a temporary naval base. And this, again, a part of this was established at Malaby, and they arrived with 6-inch guns, old 6-inch guns. I think, in actual fact, the ones that we had were 1898. The also 3-inch anti-aircraft guns. So they had 6-inch coast defense guns and 3-inch anti-aircraft guns. Colonel Andrew, pulling the whole of the defenses together, asked the Royal Marines if they would recite their guns from the originally designed position, which had been planned many years ago, so that they would control the coast road which ran from the west to the west of the airfield. There was a river valley. This is the Tavernitis River, which went up into the hills.